fill those slots. U.S. companies have been holding back since the recession, not petitioning to hire as many workers. This year is expected to be different. The window to get the petitions in opens today. Immigration firms have been working around the clock these last couple weeks to get the paperwork in. That's because so many companies are interested in sponsoring non-U.S. citizens to work. That's good news about our economy because it shows that companies are planning to expand their hiring in the coming year. Last year, it took till June to hit the cap. This year, they could be gone by the end of the week. Zoe Chace, NPR News.
The San Francisco Symphony could be back in performance as soon as tomorrow. The musicians' union and management have reached a tentative labor agreement. A walkout started on March 13th, and the San Francisco Symphony canceled an East Coast tour. This is NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Lincoln Financial Group. For over 100 years, working to help Americans take charge of their futures and become their own chief life officers.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Jim Rue at Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties on many products. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959. 367-8121.
Welcome to Focus. I'm Jeff Bossert. For baseball fans like myself, opening day is a kind of holiday. There's something about the first day of the season, wiping the slate clean from the last season, bringing a kind of excitement that would only be surpassed by the team making the playoffs. We're joined on this opening day of the 2013 season by John Thorne, the official historian for Major League Baseball. He's the author of several books, including Baseball in the Garden of Eden, which debunks the long-running belief that Abner Doubleday invented the game. He also co-authored Total Baseball, the official encyclopedia of Major League Baseball, and The Hidden Game of Baseball, which looks at baseball and statistics. Mr. Thorne also serves as chairman of Major League Baseball's Origins Committee, and he's a publishing consultant to the Pro Football Hall of Fame and the Museum of the City of New York. Welcome, John Thorne.
Howdy.
Good to have you on the show today. Later this hour, we'll also hear from University of Florida history professor Donald Spivey, the Chicago native and University of Illinois graduate, has written extensively about Negro League and Major League pitcher Satchel Paige. And he'll give a free lecture tonight about Paige and his role in the civil rights movement. That lecture is at Eastern Illinois University. We'll hear from Spivey in the second half of the conversation. So, baseball fans, we're appealing to you. What does this day mean for you? Who are you rooting for? We'd love to hear some of your opening day stories. You can call us at 333-9455 or outside the Champaign-Urbana area, 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. You can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. So, John, what does opening day mean to you personally and professionally as a fan of the sport?
Well, personally and professionally, I'll echo your intro. It wipes the slate clean in the same way that spring wipes the slate clean of winter. Yesterday was Easter, and today is opening day. And really, they're celebrating the same thing, and that's the cycle of renewal, that hope reigns eternal.
How does someone become official historian for MLB? It's not as if this is something you probably thought of years ago. I mean, how did you find this position?
Hardly. I mean, I wrote my first baseball book 40 years ago, and at that time, there was no official Major League Baseball historian. In fact, the first was Jerome Holtzman, the great Chicago sports writer, who took the post, I think, in 1998. And after he died in office, I believe, in 2009, no one rushed to replace him, and Major League Baseball did not appoint anyone. So I was both surprised and pleased for the commissioner to appoint me.
Now, this job is not something that's so much made up of learning statistics, but more about historical context as how the game was first, the origins of it, and how it's played today.
Yeah, I mean, my span as official historian is last night's box score all the way back to the 18th century. And it's not merely that I've got to know it all, because doing an impression of an ambulatory book is something you can find in any bar room. There's always some guy who knows some stat you don't know. But you're correct, it is the context and perspective that Major League Baseball appreciates and that I like to think I provide.
So what's the earliest season you can recall?
I guess that would be my first television World Series, 1955, even though I was flipping baseball cards as early as 1951 and 52.
And who are your first heroes? Who made you want to become a bigger fan of the game?
Jackie Robinson, Duke Snyder, Brooklyn Dodgers. I mean, if you're an immigrant Jew in New York City, you see yourself as an underdog, and you would naturally gravitate toward the Dodgers, whose ability to lose the World Series year after year was strangely appealing.
So you immigrated from your family immigrated from West Germany in 1949. How did you embrace it so quickly in this Americana of baseball and wanting to shed your foreign roots?
Came over here from a displaced persons camp in the American sector of occupied Germany, and felt very much the foreigner, and wanted to be like my kindergarten and nursery school classmates. And that meant I had to shuck the language and some of the customs and become somewhat disagreeable to my parents in my insistence upon being spoken to in English.
We'd love to hear from you at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. And we've got a call now. Line 4, Steve is in Champaign. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Just a couple of comments. Maybe your guests. I grew up on the south side of Chicago, and I turned out to be a Cubs fan. So there you go. I'll be tortured for the rest of my life. But it's an interesting dynamic, I think, what's going on in Chicago right now with regards to Wrigley Field and kind of the city government holding the owners hostage. I think what might happen is they might eventually move out to the suburbs. But couple of quick things. Baseball is one of the few sports that I know of. There's so much money involved, and yet, albeit the hope for opening day, three-quarters of the team, and I throw the Cubs in there, probably the White Sox, don't really have a realistic chance whatsoever of making it to the playoffs. And yet, there's so much money that's generated by the sport. I was wondering if your guest would want to extrapolate as to where he sees the sport 10, 15 years from now, especially with some of the smaller markets. And then finally, the Cubs won the World Series back in the Westside Park, which is the home of the University of Illinois Medical School. And yet, I don't think there's any sort of tribute or plaque or anything notating that. So I thought that was of interest. Anyway, enjoying the show. I'll go ahead and hang up and listen off air. Thanks.
All right. Let me respond to the second point first. A commemorative plaque for Westside Park is surely the responsibility of the city and its citizens, and not necessarily Major League Baseball. I recall that a plaque was placed at the site of the New York Yankees' first ballpark, Hilltop Park, which has become Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center. And the plaque was a product of Society for American Baseball Research members and the city. And I think that anybody who wishes to commemorate former Major League Baseball sites is to be commended, but it is a private effort. As to Major League Baseball opening day, three-quarters of the team, as you say, having no chance to make the playoffs, I would strongly disagree, and I'd ask you to look at the historical record. We have seen a greater participation in postseason play since 1990 than we did in all the years before in terms of last to first. We had one World Series in which both clubs, the Twins and the Braves, had come from last to first. I think that was 1991. So I think, especially with the expansion of the wild card, you have more chances for success. If the Cubs or the Royals or the Pirates are chronically on the outside looking in, I don't think that's Major League Baseball's issue so much as it is the franchise's issue.
Thanks, Steve, for the call, and I'll echo his comments being a long-suffering Cub fan. We can point to last night. This is just one game, and I know that the odds are against the Houston Astros, but I think their entire payroll is something like $24 million.
Less than A-Rod's salary.
Exactly, right. And they did manage to beat Texas, who have been to two of the last three World Series.
Well, I think the underdog has a real chance in baseball. In the NFL, the schedules are rigged in such a way as to penalize winners and encourage losers to move up in the standings, and I would hate for baseball to go that route.
Let's talk a bit more about some of the origins of the game. You're you headed up this origins committee a couple of years ago, and want to point out a professor on this campus, Adrian Burgos, who I've worked with a bit on some of these types of interviews, is also on that group, and a couple other notable names on there, George Will, the columnist, political columnist, and presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. Is there a simple way of explaining what this group is responsible for?
This group is responsible for reviewing the research results that will be presented to them shortly and poke holes in arguments and theses that are made. But the story of baseball as endorsed by the Mills Commission of 1908, every serious observer of baseball recognizes that Abner Doubleday is the Santa Claus of baseball. He's the mythical father of the game, and that there is no one single father. The story will be complicated and will have many points of inflection, from England in the 1740s to New England in the 1750s and 60s. So baseball grew up everywhere in a variety of forms and more or less simultaneously. And how we came to get a game that looked like the one we play today is the question before the committee.
And it seems as if this is constantly updated, because I was watching the first part one of Ken Burns' original Baseball, which you're in, yesterday, and then your book from a couple of years ago, Baseball in the Garden of Eden, seems to update a lot of that information and point to a few individuals and their role in what in the game we play today.
Absolutely. The pace of research, new finds, new understandings has accelerated in the past 20 years to an extent that no one could have envisioned. So that many of the things that are said in the Ken Burns baseball documentary are almost true, but not quite, because they have been countermanded by recent discoveries. David Block in Baseball Before We Knew It found mention of a game called Baseball described in a German book from 1796. I came across an ordinance in Pittsfield in 1791 that banned the game of baseball within 80 yards of a newly built meeting house. So if it was banned in 1791, it's not as if it were invented that year. So clearly, baseball was being played under that name and a variety of other names in New England and in the colonies generally in the 18th century.
One thing that I wanted to ask about from the part one of baseball was the role of the Civil War played, and that this was more of a gentleman's game, at least according to the 1994 documentary, and became more of a poor man's game, I guess, so to speak, with the emergence of soldiers playing when they weren't busy on the battlefield.
This perspective that you mentioned here was born of the notion that the Knickerbocker Baseball Club, which was a group of white-collar workers, not landed gentry, were responsible for most of the innovations in the game. But in the last 20 years, we've discovered that there were earlier clubs, including working man's clubs. So the nobility and gentlemanly characteristics that some of the vintage baseball players have now layered onto their recreation games are more the product of Walter Scott's Ivanhoe than they are of how baseball really developed.
We'll take your calls and questions for official Major League Baseball historian John Thorne at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 outside the immediate Champaign-Urbana area. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or reach us through Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. You mentioned the vintage teams, and a few years ago I had a chance to talk with Jim Boughton, who chairs a group that is the former Yankee pitcher that's ahead of one of these groups that has these teams that play by these 1860s rule book. Is that a reminder of what went on in that era, or is it more as just a kind of a fun novelty?
It's more a novelty, I think. I mean, there are very historically astute players, and Jim Boughton, who's a good friend of mine, likes to say that some of these vintage clubs, the players play like historians. That is, they understand the rules of the day, but they're really not very good players. And in the Vintage Baseball Federation style that Boughton pioneered and that I was associated with as a director, We did not look at the Beadle Guide of 1864 or the DeWitt Guide of 1872 and its incarnation of the rules as necessarily the Bible. These ballplayers played by a variety of rules that may have been outmoded, you know, by a given year. So the flavor of the game, say, 1880, with overhand, when overhand pitching had just begun to sneak in, was a combination of old rules, including plugging. You could pretty much make up the rules. Now, there are some vintage teams, members of the Vintage Baseball Association, who say that if you're going to play by 1864 rules, you cannot intrude anything from an earlier or a later period. You have to go by the Bible, and I find this a little fundamentalist.
Another item brought up briefly around that, I guess, 1880s, late 1800s, was the first breaking balls thrown. And once a curveball was once considered deception, and people were upset that the notion also that baseball was becoming a business and they were charging admission.
Well, the first admission was charged in 1858, so it's always been, you know, it's always been too much of a sport to be a business and too much of a business to be a sport. So people were have been complaining about the same things for 150 years. It's very amusing to the historian. The idea that the curveball was an act of deception and beneath the standards of a Harvard player, for example, were famously ascribed to President Charles Eliot. The breaking ball was first pitched, we think, by Candy Cummings in 1867 at the Cambridge campus when the Excelsiors played the Harvards. But the breaking ball of the 1860s, thrown with an underhand motion, is very different from the breaking ball of today, which breaks in two directions, both laterally and vertically.
I'm wondering how taxing your job is. Is it a lot of looking at old newspaper clippings, or where do you go to find out some more and more about the collective research or all those individuals that were involved in making this game what it is now?
There are very few new sources. I mean, the new sources have come up for sure with the digitization of ancient newspapers over the last 20 years. But it's not so much that I have to stay au courant with new resources, as I have to be open to new questions, because new questions will provide new answers. And the idea is not simply for me to know everything, but to have a sense of where it might be found or who might know the thing that I don't know. So I'm very connected with the baseball research community, and there are some real rock stars here. There are people who are as avid about understanding and perhaps rewriting the history of the game as I am.
And how odd is it that this is the only sport where you produce 30% of the time and that's considered a success?
That used to be true. It used to be true of basketball. I mean, if you look at the field goal percentages, the Minneapolis Lakers of the early 1950s, I think they led the league with a field goal shooting percentage of 39%. So this was not always true of baseball alone.
We'd love to hear from you. If you have any questions about the game today and where it's headed in terms of finances, as we talked a little while ago, 800-222-9455 outside Champaign-Urbana or immediate area 333-9455. I'm Jeff Bossert. You're listening to Focus. We're talking to Major League Baseball historian John Thorne. Are there any bizarre rules of the games going back either from the beginning of your research or when you started watching in the 50s, some of the things that we don't really think about anymore because of the way games ends, or maybe it's more about how some of the things that have been added to the game in terms of umpires determining whether a ball cleared a fence and, you know, when someone hits a home run.
Well, baseball is very resistant to change. It's a conservative game. We're a conservative people. And the designated hitter, which has provoked so much hot air over these 40 years, and this is the 40th anniversary of it, the idea was first proposed in 1892 and lost in an owner's ballot in that year, in 1892, by a vote of 7-5. At that time, there was only one league, the National League, and it contained 12 teams. So you can see that it took 80 years from first proposal to adoption, and by adoption, it means only one league, the American League. So rule changes are slow to come in, and now we have the video replay controversy. How much do we permit? And the commissioner will be slow and conservative in his introduction of these innovations. We don't want to make baseball into tennis, where the eye in the sky overrules the umpire on a repeated basis. In fact, one of the things I object to about modern baseball and that I love about vintage baseball is we now have so many plays that are routine plays, the routine grounder to short, the routine drive to the warning track that an outfielder camps under. When you watch Little League or vintage ball, there is no routine play. Everything is an adventure. So now, as errors have diminished and unearned runs are basically an artifact of the past, we have less and less intrusion of risk into the game and surprise. And for me, baseball is about story. It's about the narrative, not so much the statistics. Those statistics are powerful analytical tools for viewing the past and perhaps predicting the future. So when you get an error by an umpire, an error in judgment that is not reversible, it becomes a huge story, as with the Armando Galarraga near-perfect game of a couple of years ago.
So that's what came to my mind in the fact that he had lost a perfect game, and you have close plays at first and a lot of incidents that could hold up the game and make it, you know, a four-hour affair if so many plays were ruled via video.
I think to the extent that we can keep the human element as a constant in the game and not surrender to technology, the game is stronger. And this may be a curmudgeonly or a fuddy-duddy perspective, but the imperfection of the game is one of its strongest appeals. And Larry Ritter, my friend who wrote The Glory of Their Times, the greatest of all baseball books, used to say the best part of baseball today is its yesterdays. And I think that's correct. Baseball is an archaic, anachronistic exercise that connects generations and forms a family scrapbook for us. It plays a role in American society and culture beyond the excitement of the sport and who's going to win a particular game or a particular year's championship.
I want to, since we're talking about baseball history, I want to bring up one historical thing, and we're going to play a clip of old, really old music here. Many people are dumbfounded when I tell them that Take Me Out to the Ball Game originally had verses and that we're only singing the chorus during the seventh inning stretch.
Right.
Well, the song was written in 1908 by Jack Norworth and Albert von Tilzer. They were not baseball fans, and I don't think they had either attended a game when they wrote this song. This is the Haydn Quartet in September of 1908, and their recording of Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
Katie was baseball mad, had the fever and had it bad. Just to root for the hometown crew, every school Katie flew. On a Saturday, her young foe called to see if she'd like to go to see a show. But Miss Kate said, no, I'll tell you what you can do. Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Oh, buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I never get back. Let me root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. For it's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out at the old ball game. Take me out to the ball game.
Thanks to my friends at Archaeophone Records in Champaign, who archive old recordings. That was the Haydn Quartet recording on the Victor label in 1908. John, any thoughts about that song or early baseball music?
Well, you have baseball music going back to the 1850s. The connection between baseball and theater was much stronger. And I think that very few of our listeners have ever paused to think that we call our baseball heroes players. The name comes from the boards. It comes from the theater, that both baseball actors and theatrical actors were regarded as putting on a show that would emulate or simulate real-life activity. And the song Take Me Out to the Ball Game is such a hearty and unusual survivor because there are so many equally dreadful baseball songs, both before and after. And George M. Cohan composed a competitor to Take Me Out to the Ball Game that is a virtual, that is a real knockoff of this one, but it didn't catch on. Now, why is this song and Casey at the Bat as our great American ballad impervious to critique and impervious to time? The charm is inexplicable for Take Me Out to the Ball Game. It's more readily understood, perhaps, for Casey at the Bat because it has a dramatic twist ending.
We got a call on line one right before we take the mid-break. We want to talk to Wally in Champaign. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm curious if the situation with the drugs in, I think, recent years is ever, and the problem that causes with the statistics and over the years, if that's part of the history yet that you're looking into, and I'll listen off the air.
Of course, the steroids and other boutique drugs that have arisen in these past years and perhaps have affected performance create an issue for Major League Baseball. But there are aberrational performances in the record books at many, many points. 1930, you had a National League batting average of .303. The Phillies hit .319 and finished in last place. So if you want to start sprinkling asterisks in the record book, I would suggest that you would start, perhaps, by putting an asterisk alongside the mark of any Major League Baseball player before 1947. Once you go down this very slippery slope, you ask statistics and records to do the job of ordinary people's understanding of history, of story, and of context. And I think every statistic exists in time and place, is a product of time and place, and is best understood through a bit of narrative.
Thanks for the call. And we've got another call, Jim in Champaign. Line one, go ahead.
I've always appreciated the Take Me Out to the Ball Game. I've never known the opening verse, just the chorus. But I think if you look into the chord structure, that is the thing that certainly recommends it to me. It's really quite intricate and delicate, I would say. So I would commend you to go back and take a second look at that. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I am out of my depth in examining chord structure. It's above my pay grade, I think. But I will gladly say that Take Me Out to the Ball Game has had an enduring appeal for some reason unknown to me.
Maybe we can pass that question on to some of our more knowledgeable music hosts on the FM side sometime.
Yes.
Thanks for the call. We're going to pause now for a short break, and when we return, we'll be also joined by University of Miami history professor Donald Spivey, who's written about longtime pitcher Satchel Paige. We'll pause here for a short break. I'm Jeff Bossert. This is Focus.
Mary Roach, author of the new book Gulp, says saliva or spit doesn't get the respect it deserves. It protects the enamel on our teeth, renders viruses non-infective, kills bacteria, and contains histatins, which helps wounds heal.
Honestly, someone should bottle this stuff. It's fairly miraculous.
Mary Roach on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Burlingame Home Inspection and Performance. Burlingame performs property inspections along with energy audits and ratings for Energy Star, tax credits, and efficiency mortgages, all utilizing infrared technology. More information is at cusaveenergy.com or 217-649-1173.
And welcome back to Focus. I'm Jeff Bossert. And for Jim Meadows today, we're talking about baseball and opening day. And joining us on the phone now, along with Major League Baseball historian John Thorne, we will be talking in just a moment with University of Miami history professor Donald Spivey. He was a one-time student here at the University of Illinois. He earned his history degrees in the early 70s. He also played football for the U of I. He was a tailback for the team. He earned his Ph.D. in history from the University of California at Davis. Spivey specializes in late 19th and 20th century America with an emphasis on African-American history, sport, labor, music, and education. Writings from Mr. Spivey include The Union and the Black Musician, the narrative of Williams Everett Samuels and Chicago Local 208, Schooling for the New Slavery, Black Industrial Education, as well as the 2002 book, If You Were Only White, The Life of Leroy Satchel Paige, which came out last year. I think we're still connecting with our guest. We'll have him in just a moment. But we're talking about opening day. We'd love to hear from you if you're a particular fan, whether it's Cubs, Sox, Cardinals, or someone else. 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. And I think we've got both our guests now on the phone. John Thorne.
I'm here.
And welcome, Professor Spivey.
Hey, just call me Don. I'm here.
All right. Don, thanks for the show tonight. One thing I did not mention in that intro is that you will be speaking at Eastern Illinois University tonight about Satchel Paige. Talk a bit about that lecture.
Yeah, I'm talking about Satchel Paige and Black baseball in the reinterpreting of the Civil Rights Movement. So I'll be talking about how he was much more than just a baseball player, and how his actions and activism was really very helpful to the movement, how he helped to integrate the sport before Jackie Robinson. Not to take anything away from Jackie Robinson, that's a short version.
He grew up, just looking at some profiles, grew up poor in Mobile, Alabama, called Satchel because he made change carrying passengers' luggers at the Mobile train station. And I guess you talked a lot with family members about his upbringing?
Oh, yeah, and I talked to probably 60 or 70 Negro League ball players. But, yeah, particularly with Robert Leroy Paige, his eldest son, and his eldest daughter, Pamela Paige. And in fact, we've become pretty close. We talk all the time, not really even about baseball. We just talk.
Yeah, what else do we know about the Satchel Paige, the person, and his efforts away from the field, and what kind of personality was he?
He was a very interesting personality, very calm but very self-assured, which I guess any good pitcher has to be. But he was more diverse than people have typically given him credit for. He was a good cook. He was a gourmet cook. He was a superb dancer, international styles, etc. He knew a bit of Spanish. He played instruments, three different instruments. He loved to collect silver furniture, particularly Chippendale furniture, etc. You know, in many respects, he was sort of a Renaissance man, despite his background.
Don, you played football here at the University of Illinois. I knew you were a history major, but what from that experience, being an African-American athlete on this campus in the late 60s, perhaps helped steer you toward researching the Negro Leagues?
Well, you know, I became interested in the history of sport. In fact, Tom Jones and I, Tom Jones played on the team as well, and he stayed on the team through his senior year. I quit the team in my sophomore year because of conflicts with my studies. I needed more time. I was a history major. We were reading 15 books a week in each course. I had three history courses besides others, and I piled those books on my desk one semester. They had 45 doggone books just in those three courses. But at any rate, Tom and I did my senior year, and I think his senior year as well, we did a piece on the black athlete at the University of Illinois, which was later published in Social Science Quarterly. But I had interest in doing things on sport. And, you know, and then in the 80s, I did a collection, Rethinking Sport, and I've done articles in the Journal of Sport History. And some other things as well. And then came the opportunity to write this biography of Satchel Paige. So it was always an interest there. But in academics, particularly in that era, you didn't take on sport as your area of concentration. I mean, that was just not done. Jules Tigel, who wrote that very definitive book on Jackie Robinson, The Great Experiment. I mean, Jules had a very similar experience. He wanted to write a biography of Jackie Robinson, and he couldn't do that, not for a PhD dissertation. He would write that book much later. So similar in that respect, but sort of a calling, you know, that as an athlete you can appreciate what's going on from a different perspective, even though it was a different sport.
Since you brought up Jackie Robinson, I wanted to mention, and either of you can respond, there's this movie 42 that comes out in, I believe, the 12th. And I wonder if either of you have had a chance to see an advanced preview or just look into it a little bit.
I have not. I'm hopeful that it's good, but I'm skeptical.
Okay, I figured John might have gotten a preview. They may have shown him an early version, but no, I have not, and I hope it's going to be good.
What else about the story about Jackie Robinson or any other players and Satchel Paige? Do we have to learn about the Negro Leagues? Has it been appropriately told through biographers like Ken Burns or Don? What else do we need? The people need to learn today and appreciate about what those players went through.
We need a lot of appreciation, a great deal of understanding. Back in 2001, I was on a panel at the OAH, the Organization of American Historians, in Los Angeles, and Jules Tigel's new book had just come out, Baseball as History. And so I was moderating the session and had some historians, and then had Sharon Robinson, Jackie Robinson's daughter, on there. We got in a conversation at the end of the panel about the fact that there were Major League Baseball players who didn't know the legacy of Jackie Robinson, to say nothing of the public. And she was talking about how she was making that part of her life's mission, not only through the Jackie Robinson Foundation, but through Jackie's Nine, which she runs herself. And you can see the end results. I'm really familiar with that, but I'm sure he is. That was the part of the movement to get the Jackie Robinson Day, which we now have since 2004. And that's not just to educate Major League Baseball players. That's to educate the public about the importance.
That's right, because Jackie's legacy is for the general public more than for the Major League player who is so caught up in his own activity, he's busy making history, and only after he retires does he have a chance to really understand his place in it.
Okay.
We have a call on line one, Lawrence in Savoy. Go ahead.
Good morning. I think I have a couple things worthwhile here, but first I need to make sure I'm on the right track. Was Satchel Paige a pitcher for the St. Louis Browns?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Then, in your research, did you come across why the Browns were called the Browns, and who came first, the Cardinals or the Browns? And, of course, the Browns had nothing to do with the skin color in the Negro Baseball League.
I'll leave that to John.
I'm happy to speak to that. The St. Louis Browns that you may remember, the team in the 50s that eventually moved to Baltimore and that Satchel Paige pitched for a couple of years, their logo was that of the Brownie, Palmer Cox's Brownies, which were a very popular illustrated series of children's books at the turn of the century. But the St. Louis Browns name goes back to the champion St. Louis Browns of the 1880s in the American Association, and their name derived not from Palmer Cox, but from the color of their stockings. And they preceded the Cardinals.
The color of their what?
Their stockings.
Oh, stockings. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, like the red socks, white socks. So instead of brown socks, they were just browns.
Thanks for the call. I want to talk a bit about Satchel Paige's abilities. I mean, he was a rookie in his 40s when he finally reached the major leagues. And I believe he was, had finished close in the balloting for Rookie of the Year. Was that in 42?
Yeah, but they changed the procedure. I'm sure John could speak to that in terms of how they selected the Rookie of the Year right around that time. It used to be by Sporting News used to select the Rookie of the Year, and then
That's right. The first Rookie of the Year award was the year before in 47, and Jackie Robinson was the recipient, which is one of the reasons that the Rookie of the Year award is now named for him.
Okay.
Yeah. We'd love to hear from you regarding the baseball season. 333-9455, baseball history, opening day. We're talking to official Major League Baseball historian John Thorne and University of Miami history professor Donald Spivey about Satchel Paige. 800-222-9455 is the out-of-area phone number. You can also reach us on Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580 or write us at will-talk@illinois.edu. So Satchel Paige pitched well into his 50s. How much velocity had he lost or had he?
Hey, remember this. He pitched his final game in 1965, pitching for the Kansas City Athletics. He was 59 years of age, and he pitched three good innings.
Three scoreless innings.
Right, there you go. I couldn't walk three innings. I mean, you know, I can imagine. He was a heck of an incredible athlete. I mean, the thing that always comes to my mind is the statement made by Bill Veeck, which I think is a fascinating one. He said that if Satchel Paige had come into the majors in his prime, today's Cy Young Award would be known as the Satchel Paige Award.
We've got a clip here I want to play. Former reporter here at WILL, Rob Schober, sent us some tapes a couple weeks ago. And another giant in Negro League history, both as a player and a coach and ambassador to that history, was Buck O'Neill. And Rob had interviewed O'Neill back in 93 and included a clip of a conversation here. This is a response when Rob talked about the barnstorming of players in the Negro Leagues or changing teams regularly in between the regularly scheduled games. This response had to do with Satchel Paige making the jump to the majors, joining the Clevelands in 1948.
A lot of people didn't realize, but when Satchel went to Cleveland, the major leagues, Satchel was probably getting a cut because Satchel, a cut in salary. Because Satchel was making more money in Negro baseball than he did when he went to the major league because of what he was doing. See, Satchel, the way the Monarchs used Satchel was Satchel pitched for some of everybody. He belonged to the Monarchs, but we would lease him out to other ball clubs. Like he would pitch here in Kansas City. He'd pitch three innings Sunday, and Monday he probably even just might pitch in Memphis for the Memphis Red Sox and every way he pitched he drew a crowd and might pitch with some semi-pro team someplace in North Dakota or Canada, but all of this, and Satchel was getting a percentage of these gates, so he was making good money.
Don Spivey, any response to that?
Well, yeah, he's absolutely right in terms of him making good money. We were able to document that a number of years he made $40,000, which was a lot of money back then, considering a lot of major league players were making like $5,000. But when he went to Cleveland, remember, he went for half the season, and I think he got 20-something thousand for half season. So that still was not bad. At all, but he wouldn't set any records in terms of pay. And the question of whether he could have kept making, you know, he kept playing in the Negro Leagues. When the season was over, he hit the road barnstorming, et cetera. But there was another true fact that once the gates opened with Jackie Robinson in the majors, Negro League attendance, you can show starts that decline. In terms of attendance, et cetera. Satchel Paige could still pull them in, and when the black players who were now in the majors went on the road, they could pull them in. But Negro League baseball was, shall we say, the fat lady was getting ready to sing, and she sung very shortly thereafter.
And that's why Jackie Robinson's legacy is a complicated one, because he opened the doors for African Americans into the majority culture version of baseball, but helped to speed the demise of one of the great economic as well as cultural institutions of African American life.
I also wanted to point out Buck O'Neill, who we just heard from, was made a lot of contributions not only as a player but a coach for the Kansas City Monarchs. He was also the first African American coach on a big league club with the Cubs in the early 60s. He passed away in October of 2006 at age 94. Donna, did you ever have a chance to talk to Buck?
Oh, many times. When you played that tape, I immediately recognized that that voice. That was definitely him, a gentleman to the end. I interviewed him maybe five or six different times. The first few times at the Negro Leagues Museum there in Kansas City, Missouri, and then several other times follow-ups on the on the phone. He was always gracious, always spirited, and always on the road. They called him, you know, Mr. Kansas City. I mean, he was a promoter not just for black interests, I mean, for all of Kansas City. He was like a tourist stop. You had to meet Buck O'Neill, et cetera, go by the Negro Leagues Museum and hear him talk about Satchel Paige, Negro League baseball, and pro baseball, as you mentioned, the major leagues as well.
One of the things that you mentioned, Don, was that Satchel Paige was a factor in integrating baseball prior to Jackie Robinson. Were you referring to the Bismarck, North Dakota?
Yeah, you know it. You know it. You know it, John. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because that was a big deal. I mean, he started, of course, with them in 1933, but in 1935 they won the semi-pro championship, and that was a very integrated team, six blacks, six whites. Well, five white players, including Neil Churchill, the owner, manager of the team. And they not only were completely integrated. When I say integrated, I mean the fact that if they went to a restaurant and they wouldn't serve blacks there, the whole team wouldn't eat there. If they went to a hotel and they would not accept blacks at the hotel, the whole team left. And not only that, they had a number of instances, according to Joe Desterado, who was one of the white members of the team, and others confirmed this, where there were cases at night, hotels that would accept them, and there was a shortage of rooms, say three or four rooms for all 12 of them. This was the first team I can find where black players and white players roomed together in the same room. These were just human beings, decent folk, but they show you what it can be and should be in the future.
Got just a few minutes left talking on opening day of the baseball season with MLB historian John Thorne. Around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 or outlying area 800-222-9455. Another portion of the Ken Burns original baseball documentary I watched was Chapter 5, all about the Negro Leagues and the heyday that existed then and the huge crowds they had around. I hope I'm on target here with the dates here, but around a Depression era when they were still drawing real big crowds when some of the major league audiences were suffering.
Huge crowds, absolutely huge crowds, particularly for their East-West game, which was their all-star game, a number of times. I mean, 50,000 or more at those games. They were routine, very often beating the major league teams and bringing the fans into the stands. And, you know, and the black baseball was an outing. Well, major leagues in general was an outing, but particularly black baseball, I mean, people were dressed, as they say, to the nines. I mean, they had on women with the long gloves and hats and high-heeled shoes, men in their three-piece suits and so forth. It was a real happening.
I'd like to point out for your listeners is that this is an opening day program that we're engaged in here, and the greatest of all opening days is, in fact, Jackie Robinson's debut, April 15th, 1947. Now, today, opening day has been pushed forward. It used to begin 2 weeks and sometimes 15, 17 days later. So Jackie Robinson's debut on April 15th, which we commemorate as Jackie Robinson Day, was an opening day.
Good point.
And the season used to be as short as, I believe, 68 games back when you had, five, seven teams around the late 1800s?
It was a little bit longer now.
It's been 154 games. It was 154 games from the 1890s until 1961, right, when expansion kicked in. But in the early years of baseball, yeah, your schedule was as few as 60 games in 1876 and it's crept up pretty slowly.
Another aspect of the baseball history thing with any young listeners have to recognize that you go back to before the playoffs, any kind of playoffs. I mean, you probably knew right away whether you were, let's say, the Yankees at one end of the spectrum, maybe the Cubs at the other, that you knew pretty early on whether you're going to play in the World Series. I mean, because there were no other rounds of playoffs.
Don't get me started about the Cubs, but you go ahead.
That's true, and you know, curmudgeonly types of whom I'm sometimes a member complain that it's easier to amass World Series records, you know, like most home runs or most doubles, because you get to play in more postseason games. So that Mickey Mantle surpassed Babe Ruth for most home runs, and then Reggie Jackson surpassed the both. But I like the way things are now. And when you look at a club like the Atlanta Braves, who were the National League East champions, I think 13 out of 14 or maybe even 14 years in a row, this is a level of accomplishment that is pretty parallel to the Yankees of, say, 49 to 53. The whole postseason structure is different, and I like it better.
But look, can I ask a question here?
Yes.
I have a question for John. I have my own answer to this, but as we watch the continual rise of basketball and football as, you know, the American pastime, why do you think that's the case? I know I have my thinking, but I talk to different people that all have their own reasons.
I think basketball and football have both pushed past baseball as, by some measures, America's most popular game. Mm-hmm. But I think baseball is and will always be the national pastime because it reflects the American temperament and connects us with our forebears, our real ones and our imagined ones. So I think baseball is a far more important institution than merely a sport.
Don't you think it's more, too, of a cerebral game than some of the other games?
Yeah, George Plimpton used to say that he had a theory that the smaller the ball, the better the writing and the thinking. But the problem with that is that it makes golf the supreme sport, and of course, golf
well
spoiled.
Well, I want to give Don, we have to wrap up the conversation here in a minute, a chance to plug your lecture again, and that's free at the EIU campus tonight.
Right, at 7 o'clock, speaking on Satchel Paige and black baseball in the rethinking of the civil rights movement.
And that's in the Dubna Fine Arts Center on the campus.
I don't know the campus that well, but yes, that's where I'm told it will be.
Well, I want to thank both our guests today, MLB historian John Thorne. John, any other writings we can expect from you in the near future?
I have a Cy Young biography that's in the works. It's a year late, and my publisher is after me to write faster and write better.
I will look forward to that.
Sounds familiar.
Maybe we
for
can,
all of us.
Maybe we can talk to you about that. And University of Miami history professor and U of I graduate, Don Spivey. Thanks so much for being on the program.
My pleasure.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Our members of the Focus team include Pam Dempsey and Kimberly Chronic. Mike Pritchard is our technical director and handled your calls today. Tomorrow, Jim Meadows is back in the program host chair on the trouble of law school, too expensive, producing too many graduates, chasing too few jobs. He'll be talking to State Bar Association President John Thies. Remember, Focus is live each day morning at 10 a.m. on AM 580 with a rebroadcast at 8 this evening. We love additional thoughts to your program at will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm Jeff Bossert. This is Focus.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Good Monday morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets as we head into the final few hours of trading today. Goldman Sachs today cut its 3-month U.S. corn futures price forecast to $6.50 a bushel from $7.50 after USDA's report last week showed more domestic corn stockpiles than widely believed. The report implies weak corn demand in the feed and residual category, and the report also says USDA may have underestimated last year's corn production. It also cut its 3-month soybean price forecast to $13.50 a bushel from $14. Let's go ahead and look at particulars. in Kansas City. May wheat trading 7.11 and a quarter, down 15 and a half. July 7.17, down 15 and a quarter. May wheat in Chicago 6.71 and a quarter, down 16 and a half. July 6.76 and a quarter, down 14 and a quarter, now 15 and a quarter. May corn 6.54 and three quarters, down 40 and a half. December 5.32 and a half, down 6 and a quarter. May beans 13.95, down 9 and 3 quarters. November 12.55, up 3 and a half. May soybean meal 3.99.10, down 5.50. May soybean oil 50.19, up 8 cents, now up 7 cents. You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana.